Welcome to the UK MSDN podcast show 10. In this podcast, I sit down with Paul Jackson and we talk about memory map files in .NET 4.0. This podcast was recorded on Thursday the 8th of October. It is a companion show to the Flash newsletter published on the same day. All the links mentioned in the show can be found at bit.ly/MSDN podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Hi there all. We had some interesting announcements over the few weeks leading up to this podcast and the accompanying newsletter. The first one that stuck out was the announcement of Website Spark. Website Spark is designed for independent web developers and web development companies that build web applications and websites on behalf of others. You get software, you get support, and you get business resources from Microsoft at no cost for 3 years. And it looks really cool stuff. A lot of you will be thinking about, well, what's this free software? Well, you get three licenses of Visual Studio 2008 Professional, a license of Expression Studio 3, which includes your Expression Blend, Sketchflow, and Expression Web. You also get two separate licenses of Expression Web 3, four processor licenses of Windows Web Server 2008 R2, four processor licenses of SQL Server 2008 Web Edition. So that's well worth checking out. So do check the show notes for the linkage on that. Next up, we had the announcement of the Microsoft Ajax CDN, or Content Delivery Network. It provides caching support for Ajax libraries, which sounds really cool, including, you know, your jQuery and ASP.NET Ajax libraries that you want to work with. Completely free from Microsoft, doesn't require any registration, and you can use it for, you know, fun, you can use it for commercial applications. Basically, it's edge cache servers that are placed around the world at key internet network points. These edge servers can be used to cache and deliver all types of content, images, videos, cascading style sheets, JavaScript files, etc. Basically, the reason for using a CDN is to improve your website's end user performance. It enables the browsers to more quickly retrieve and download that content. Do check that one out. The third announcement was that the web platform installer 2.0 is released. It's been in beta for a little while. It's probably the easiest way of getting all the right bits to do web development on the Windows platform installed on a box, plus access to the Windows Web Application Gallery, which has all those great applications in there. Everything from galleries just to, you know, embed photo galleries into your website, through to content management systems, through to commerce, CRM systems, lots and lots of different applications. At the same time as we released Web Platform Installer version 2, we also launched a bunch of web application toolkits. Now, these are small sample applications that allow you to easily get up to speed on how you can accomplish a small web development task with an application. There are toolkits on adding Bing to your website, getting your app to work better with IE8, mobile, adding an FAQ to your website, making your web app social, template-driven email, and adding a REST API to your website. There is a short screencast for each of those up on Channel 9, plus some additional videos explaining what the web application toolkits are all about. I like this sort of stuff. It's good. It's interesting. It's easy to get your head around. And it gives you an easy idea how to add that sort of capability into an application. Which leads me on to the fresh discovery. I only wanted to point out one fresh discovery in the podcast, and that is actually a case study. And I rarely include case studies in the newsletter, and I would rarely point out a case study in the newsletter. But this one stood out for me. The reason I picked out that case study is because it talks about why developers chose to use F# to implement some functionality. So for years on the .NET platform, developers have basically chosen between writing Visual Basic .NET or writing C#. And they're both very comparable languages. They both take, you know, roughly the same lines of code to get the same thing done. I think it's a great example of how if you take a different language that's better suited to the problem domain, you can potentially write a lot less code, which makes it a lot easier to maintain, which gives savings both in terms of the initial development and the ongoing lifetime of that application. And there's a nice little quote in there. By using F#, we reduced the rating code size by nearly 75%, which is great, which is exactly the reason you would go about picking up another language. So that leaves us with a couple of bits. One is the poll. This time I've gone for a much simpler, easier poll, which is just how many lines of code did you write yesterday? And the final bit I wanted to mention from the Flash newsletter is the UK user group that we call out. We call out a different one in each edition of the newsletter. This time it's the Wessex Scrum user group. It takes place in the Dorset-Hampshire border. Everyone is welcome if you have an interest in Scrum. That's certainly enough of me. It's time to listen to the interview I did with Paul Jackson, who wrote the article on .NET Framework 4 and memory mapped files. And in part of that interview, we did digress into various things. We did talk about looking again at ASP.NET, and he covered off some of the stuff he's been doing with MVC and with XAML. I hope you enjoy it.
Hey, Eric.
Oh, hello there, Paul. How are you? You
good? I'm good. I'm good.
Excellent.
Busy, but good.
So what are you working on today?
I'm doing a couple of projects at the moment. One is for the Microsoft Surface Boys, and I'm also working on an internal project.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, where you work, and all that kind of good stuff.
I work for a company called ContentMaster, which is based in the UK, and I work as a principal technologist, where I generally create developer-focused courseware, but other technical content for developers and designers, but for developers mainly. As a company, we're a Microsoft Gold partner and a Microsoft Premier vendor. And I do spend an awful lot of my time actually working for Microsoft or developing internal products that we either resell or just use internally for producing content. My primary focus as a developer these days is in anything to do with XAML. So hence Surface work with WPF and also WPF courseware. I've also done some stuff for PDC, getting stuff ready for PDC, again, around WPF, and bunches of courseware around Silverlight as well. Prior to that, I was a technical architect for a private security company for about 7 years. So my history with .NET goes back to mid-2002 to 2003 with the early betas.
It must be time that you jumped platform and did something completely different. I was talking to someone in London, very similar background to both you and I, been in .NET right since the early days, and they were just like, I'm bored. And I went, what, you're dissatisfied with .NET? You said, no, I love .NET. I think .NET's fantastic. I just suddenly realized I'm bored. I looked at him and I went, how many wives have you had? And he went, on my third. I can see an immediate sort of, you know, match between these two things. So I'll almost certainly cut that out of the podcast.
I think that the serious answer to that, though, is that the platform's so vast, and I haven't spent my career in one place. I mean, it all started in those early, in the early noughties. It really was about web for me and ASP.NET, whereas that migrated as I became more senior within the company. I started looking at different areas of the technology and dealing with different bits of technology. I wasn't a code monkey building UIs anymore. You know, I was building framework tools, and then it became messaging and security. So things like ESBs and web services and, you know, WCF in the later part, just as it was starting to come out. And now I've transitioned back to UIs again, but this time on the Windows platform. So, you know, I've had a different speciality over those years.
Yeah, there is loads and loads of different things you can do in the .NET space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've spent a lot of time doing integration, messaging integration. So with things like business intelligence systems and enterprise service bus and that kind of layer. And as a technical architect in those later years, that was really what I was doing, was messaging and application integration. So to move away and to just get back to being a coder again.
In fact, you just did a post on Oslo, didn't you, on your blog, which I'll put my hand up. I haven't read yet, but I did notice it appear in my RSS feed. But I just haven't looked at it yet.
Yeah, so I've been using that for this ASP.NET MVC internal project that I've been doing for the reviewer portal. Rather than spending huge amounts of time writing database layer and, you know, left-hand, right-hand code, you know, this property maps to that property, I thought I'd give Oslo a spin just in terms of modeling. So I've just been using the M and spitting out scripts to then push out into the data store, and then using Link to SQL as my data access layer. That's actually been a really nice little round trip to be able to change the model, because the model is in a really nice way to represent what I want to do, and I don't have to care about the code in between.
Okay. I must admit, I've not looked at it yet. I'm pretty sure that in our little team, none of us have looked at it yet. And
but I think there's another CTP coming out towards the end of the year, so I think you've got plenty of time.
Excellent. That'll be the one to wait for.
Yeah, I think it's November, because through Twitter, I've been talking to Chris Sells.
Right.
Just through a couple of problems I've seen, and also what the roadmap was, and I seem to remember he said around November.
Okay, well, look forward to that. That'll probably be a good time to start trying it then. We bumped into each other at GL.net, didn't we, over in Gloucester, which is a user group run by Jimmy Smits.
Yeah.
That's when we started talking about an article. And we chose to do, quite a simple one, but we both thought it was quite an interesting one, which was the addition of memory mapped file capabilities straight into .NET 4. So that's the article that you produced for us. That goes out in the Flash, which should have went out yesterday, but I'm pretty sure it'll go out today because we had a few hiccups internally. And do you want to have a go at explaining it to us then? Because I think it's interesting. I think if you've gone straight into the .NET platform and you missed doing C and C++ development, you may not have come across memory map files and why you'd use them. So we should probably start with, what's a memory mapped file?
So memory map files and my introduction to them, funnily enough, wasn't on the Windows platform. It was a way we used to solve communicating between processes on a Linux platform. Again, this is around integration and my role as an architect way back when. So when I saw this come out in .NET 4, it piqued my interest. And we've been able to do memory map files in Windows for quite a while, but you'd have to use pinvoke, and it's a core platform service. And it's how a bunch of the existing communication models, so things like COM, OLE, and RPC systems, and even Windows messages themselves, actually pass messages between processes themselves. That's how they actually work. So it's a very low-level capability of the operating system, which they've now surfaced in managed code. And the basic idea is that you either have – there's two ways to do it, but the simplest way to do it is to actually have a physical file on disk, which pretends to be memory. If you think of it as a virtual memory file, it isn't. It's not really how it works, but it's a nice way to think about it, where two processes can read and write from this file at known positions. So it enables you to share information or share data across process boundaries in a very quick and efficient way. And to show how quick and efficient it is, all these existing platform systems do it. You know, so things like COM and Win messages actually use it, and sockets themselves actually. So it's a very efficient way to pass data between processes. And you can layer lots of different things on top of that, like security and different ways to different views, they're actually called, to be able to access the data. It's a very efficient way to access memory and share memory between processes.
Yeah, and you see people using that technique both between processes and also just more granularly just between threads as well. You'll see folks doing that sort of thing. So you mentioned one way was to have a physical file that you mapped. And the other way, of course, is to not bother with the physical file at all.
That's right. The actual way you consume that in code is no different because you just apply a view. It's just how you actually then create this memory mapped file. I haven't actually looked at the other method that deeply. It's the file-based version that I've had a look at.
No, that's fair enough. So lots of people who will be listening to this will probably go, wow, that sounds incredibly straightforward, but that doesn't seem to mention terms like Windows Communication Foundation. So there are choices, and there's always choices on platform, and that's something you delve into in the article. So when somebody sits in front of you and says, you know, memory map files, when should I look at them, when should I not look at them, how do you answer that one?
The way I think about it is if I think at any point in the development or the life cycle of this application is ever going to be distributed across machines, then I'd start with WCF, because then it just becomes configuration changes. You know, you might start life as a name pipe binding and then migrate out. But if you think that your application is always going to be isolated within a single machine over just over multiple processes, then I'll probably start with memory map files and wait and see if I hit a boundary with it, because the performance is there and the ease of use is there. And the real thing for me is sometimes when you just want to send a few bytes over the wire, you don't really need the WS star stack actually unwinding and winding backwards and forwards just to send a few bytes of information.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And in terms of how easy these things are to get going, you really are talking about, depend on how you approach writing code, two or three lines of code to get one of these things, because you just need a file stream initially, and then you just call memory map file.create from file.
That's it. Yeah, the process is, that's right, the process is really simple. Start, as you say, with a file stream, create a memory map file, and then you only need one additional thing over the top of that, which is a view. And the view is the thing that allows you to read and write to that stream.
And that's where we go up to the memory mapped file reference we have, and we just do a create view accessor against
that's
that.
It.
Yeah, no, so it is really straightforward. You can do, I mean, I will put my hands up again and just say I've never actually used them in .NET 4 yet, and I keep meaning to, but they look so simple, I figure I'll just figure it out once I actually come to need one. But you can do interesting things with them. You can expand and truncate memory map files. Have you played with that? Have you needed to play with that for any work?
No.
No,
I haven't, but I can see where that would come in, because the other use for memory map files is for dealing with very, very large files, where you don't want to deal with massive amounts of I/O trying to actually run around this file. So memory map files are actually used in programs like Word and other applications that can potentially deal with very large files.
Yes, and I mean, when we're talking about large size, I'm now desperately looking through the documentation, which is online, and it's in the show notes and in the Flash newsletter. But I'm just skimming through, and it says here, yeah, so your limitation is the free virtual address space in your application, which is around 8 terabytes if you have a 64-bit Windows operating system and compile your .NET apps in 64-bit. So I'm pretty sure that would be way beyond what I'd never need.
Yeah. Unless you're writing SQL Server in managed code.
Yes.
You'll be fine.
And you might want to do it. On a 32-bit system, the limit is apparently 2 gigabytes, which makes sense. Okay, that makes sense as well.
So if you were doing some multimedia application or DVD-based application where you wanted to, you know, hop around the file for some reason, then that might be a good choice.
And that might be a good choice. So they are quite flexible. So we said we can use them between threads, we can use them between processes, we can use them with real files, without files. We could use them to do something as simple as passing a string between two threads, or something much bigger like dealing with, multi-gigabyte, terabyte, large physical file. Quite an interesting thing to look at. So I'm glad we got the article in there. I think a few folks will start to use it. I didn't actually come across many people who use them through PInvoc in my years with .NET, but I think we'll see a bunch of that stuff happening now, because we've just made it that little bit simpler and kind of given it a thumbs up that it's a reasonable thing to do. That's probably that bit done. Where are you spending your next few weeks?
So I'm developing an application using ASP.NET and MVC at the moment for an internal product, and I'm also doing some work on Microsoft Surface, which is quite interesting. It's not something I've had a chance to look at yet, so trying to get my head around all the moving parts of a Surface application without actually having one in my office. For some reason, they don't want to ship one to me.
This mean of them, yes.
I'll have to make do with the emulator.
I'd send you mine, but I haven't got one either. You mentioned there ASP.NET MVC. Is that your first MVC application with ASP.NET? Or?
It's my first production application, yes, absolutely. I've done quite a bit with it. My development history started with classic ASP when IE3 was fun and everybody wanted it. So I've got quite a long history with ASP. So it's quite a welcome addition for me. I fell out of love with the web. A few years ago, a good 3 or 4 years ago, it was just becoming too complicated and hard for such a simple thing. The big lie, I think it's known as, with web controls and whatever, really started to grate. And to see MVC come back, it's really sparked my interest in the web again. It's made it simple. Another project I'm doing with ASP.NET MVC is a private project at the moment. For a time management system that's using MVC as a REST-based system. So rather than using WCF and a lot of the REST toolkits and also my history in messaging over the last few years before this job, I've got quite a lot of experience in sending messages around, that MVC and REST just seem to be a really good marriage. You do have to work a bit, but I think that will come with time.
You've actually just described one of the things I did, which was I did do quite a lot of ASP.NET in the early days .NET, and equally fell out of love with doing web development. And thought, I'm not going to go near that. For me, I actually went data. I sort of went, okay, I'll let someone else deal with all the pain of doing web development, and I'll go and do the data stuff behind it. And it was only this week I finally decided I cannot avoid it any longer. And I need to move back. MVC sparked my interest over the last 6 months, 9 months, probably a bit longer. But other than playing with it, you know, just going, oh, look, that's straightforward. I hadn't done anything with it, and I finally decided, and I do quite like to read a good book, so I finally decided to order a book just this week from Amazon. And what was funny about that was you go to choose a book from Amazon, and you realize the book you've selected only comes from a person who lives 10 miles down the road from where you live. So I plumped for Professional ASP.NET MVC Framework by Steven Sanderson. And Steven's a top guy, speaks at the user groups. He spoke at, when did I last see him? DDD Southwest over in Taunton. And I looked at Amazon, I read the reviews, and I went, yep, that's the one for me. It seems to have the right depth that I'm looking for. And it hasn't blooming well come yet. So my little window to learn.
I could suggest an alternative.
Which one would you go for?
The way I got involved with, the way I found the book I eventually learned ASP.NET from, MVC from, was the Rob Connery, Scott Hanselman, Phil Hack, and Scott Guthrie book.
Ah, the nerd dinnery kind of book.
Yeah, and it's because the first chapter, I tend to learn best, and I know we all learn differently, I tend to learn best from looking at code and actually getting my hands dirty rather than reading or training or anything like that. And the very first chapter of the book is a complete application from the ground up, from start to finish. And that first chapter is available for free because it's written by Scott Guthrie, and he agreed to do it for Rocks Press only if they'd give it away for free. And that was what I started with. And after reading that spurred me on to actually buy the whole book, and I'm really glad I did.
Now, it's interesting you mention that, because I did download that PDF the moment Scott put it on his website, and it got put in my things to do if I ever get near web development again. What is strange, I've been doing quite a bit of cloud, but again, when I think of cloud computing with Azure, I just tend to look at the data piece. And it's quite funny, because if you ever see me do a cloud session, you won't see much fancy web in front. So I figure it's time. So I might look at that again. I mean, now you've recommended it to me, although loads of people have, but I seem to have just blanked it. But I'm going to look at
it. No, I did. I sat down for a day and went through it. It was worth it.
I'm opening the PDF now. There you go. So yeah. I've got 6 minutes after this podcast to look at it. So I'm going to have a read.
You do have to hack around with the CS proj file if you want to put it on Azure, though.
Okay. That, which is where I'd like to get it, to get that to work. I'm sure somebody's blogged about that somewhere.
They have. Yes. I think that's where I heard about it.
Marvellous. Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Paul.
And to you, Eric.
And let's catch you up sometime soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye. Cheers.